Good evening, I'm William Brangham. Amna Nawaz and Jeff Bennett are away. On the NewsHour tonight, Hamas and Israel trade ceasefire claims as Israel launches a targeted operation in parts of Rafah and demands tens of thousands leave the crowded city. Then, new witnesses in Donald Trump's hush money trial in New York detail the payments at the very heart of the case. And basketball star Brittany Griner opens up about her arrest and imprisonment in Russia.
It was really hard not being able to play, not knowing what was to come, if I would ever pick up a basketball professionally again. It was devastating to me to think about.
It is a delicate and momentous moment in the Middle East. The Israeli military tonight says it has launched a new operation into parts of Rafah in southern Gaza. At the same time, the Israeli government says it's continuing negotiations to reach a ceasefire in its war on Hamas in exchange for the release of Israeli hostages. It has been a day with fast-moving, competing headlines. And thankfully, Nick Schifrin is here to break it all down for us. So, Nick, what is the latest on the hostage negotiations?
The headline tonight, William, is that negotiations continue. But what got us here is not a straight line. Late last week, U.S., Egyptian, and Qatari mediators offered Hamas what the U.S. called a, quote, extraordinarily generous proposal approved by Israel. That would be a period of calm for 40 days. Hamas would release 33 hostages, the female, the elderly, and the infirm. Israel would release some 700 Palestinian detainees. And after those releases, Gazans would have freedom of movement within Gaza, and the two sides would discuss a permanent ceasefire and withdrawal of troops from Gaza. Now, early today, Hamas released a statement of its, quote, approval of an Egyptian and Qatari proposal regarding the ceasefire agreement. Israeli officials quickly told me that Hamas had not approved anything, or what it had approved was not the deal on the table. The reality is somewhere in the middle, William. U.S. officials confirmed that Hamas responded to the proposal, didn't accept anything. At the same time, their response is being called positive by regional officials that I speak to. We do not have the exact details of how Hamas is asking for the proposal to be changed. What we do know is that the Israeli War Cabinet has released a statement about what Hamas said today, and that statement is, quote, although the Hamas proposal is far from Israel's position, Israel will send a delegation of working-level mediators to exhaust the possibility of reaching an agreement under conditions acceptable to Israel. So, Israel has neither accepted nor denied Hamas's proposal today, and so the negotiations continue.
So, meanwhile, Israel has always been talking about going into Rafah. What is the latest on that?
The War Cabinet in that statement also said that it would continue military operations in Rafah to, quote, exert military pressure on Hamas. And there are early reports right now that, in fact, Israeli ground troops, including tanks, have crossed from Israel toward Rafah. Israeli officials tell me this is a, quote, targeted operation designed to keep the negotiations pressure on Hamas. This is not the Rafah operation that you and I and U.S. officials and Israeli officials have been talking about that Israel says is required to kill the last four battalions of Hamas, and it's about a few thousand fighters that are part of that. And the U.S. continues to reject that idea for a Rafah operation, as John Kirby, national security spokesman, said today.
We've been very clear that we don't support a major ground operation in Rafah, operations in general that put at greater risk the more than a million people that are sheltering there.
Asked if Israel had presented the administration a, quote, comprehensive plan to evacuate so many people from Rafah and assault the city, Kirby had a one-word answer, no.
Meanwhile, the fate of this hostage deal seems intertwined with what could or could not unfold in Rafah. Why is this so a delicate moment?
On the diplomatic front, it is critical because U.S. officials say a ceasefire and therefore no Rafah operation would unlock some of the regional goals that they have, including Saudi normalization. And today, Saudi Arabia released a pointed statement saying that any Rafah operation would, quote, limit international peace efforts. And the statement actually mentioned the word genocide. A Rafah operation could also lead the U.S. to impose restrictions on weapons to Israel. Now, on the humanitarian front, U.S. officials say any operation in Rafah would make it impossible to deliver enough aid to more than a million people who are taking shelter there, many of whom have been displaced multiple times.
This morning, they evacuated with everything they could carry after the Israeli army dropped leaflets from the sky urging 100,000 Gazans in eastern Rafah to flee to Al-Mawasi, already a tent city.
If the offensive is to happen, it's going to be catastrophic.
Moses Kondoe is the Gaza team lead of international humanitarian organization Project Hope. He spoke to us last week from Rafah. Of 1.2 million displaced in the city, half are kids, and one in five children are malnourished.
I see people who are in fear. And what I see, especially in the morning, are long winding queues where people will be jostling to get the limited available water.
The UN says in northern Gaza, famine is imminent. But this weekend, World Food Program Executive Director Cindy McCain went further.
Is that there is famine, full-blown famine in the north, and it's moving its way south.
Today, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu agreed to a request from President Biden to open Kerem Shalom, a key crossing in southern Israel, which had been temporarily closed this weekend, William, because Hamas attacked the crossing, killing four Israeli soldiers and disrupting aid into Gaza. But that will reopen, U.S. officials say, basically tonight or tomorrow.
Nick Schifrin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We turn now to Aaron David Miller. He's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and someone who has played a key role in U.S. Middle East policy for multiple American presidents. Aaron David Miller, great to have you back on the NewsHour. What do you make of what transpired today? You heard what Nick's been reporting. Hamas saying, yes, we agreed to this deal. Israel saying, I'm not so sure what you've agreed to. How do you see this?
You know, we went from the top of the mountain briefly to the valley below in about 3 hours. My take is very simple. Neither side is in a hurry to reach an agreement, but both want to blame the other for obstructing one. And I think that's what you're seeing play out right now. Hamas's proposal, the one they agreed to, is one, at least the Wall Street Journal is reporting terms that no Israeli government could accept. The reality is the Prime Minister of Israel is under no pressure. In fact, his coalition, frankly, would be more stable if he didn't risk Hamas for prisoner exchange. And he's juggling balls, as he usually does. The Rafah operation, or some limited operation, may or may not go forward in the days and weeks ahead. He's also managing to send a delegation in good faith to Doha or Cairo to continue negotiations on a proposal that he's simply not prepared to accept. And Hamas will continue to play this game as well. They do not want to trade hostages, any hostages, for anything other than a comprehensive deal, which leads to a permanent ceasefire, the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza, and I suspect Yahya Sinwar ensconced in some tunnel meters below ground in Rafah Khan Yunis, or maybe even in Sinai, surrounded by hostages, plans to survive this and to lead Hamas in the post-conflict period and play a major role in what transpires in Gaza. So to reach a deal, parties have to be in a hurry. And the only party that I understandably, to be sure, that's in a hurry is the Biden administration.
Yeah, I mean, the conditions that you're describing are things that no Israeli president, let alone Bibi Netanyahu, could say yes to.
I think that's right. And I guess the real question is there any pressure that can be exerted on either party to bring them around to some middle position which tries to square the circle of conflicting demands and political necessities that both Hamas and the government of Israel, the Netanyahu government, and the war cabinet are operating under? And right now, 7 months, this is the seventh month of the war this week. I don't see any lever, frankly, right now that can be pulled that could free hostages, de-escalate Israeli military activity, and surge humanitarian assistance into Gaza. That's the real tragedy here. I see no way out of this right now. It's what I would describe to you as a strategic cul-de-sac with no way out right now.
I mean, given everything that you're describing there, we know the Biden administration has been trying somewhat fruitlessly to pressure the Israelis on this front. What would you be counseling them to do? What can they do to move that needle in any way?
You know, all politics is local, and Tip O'Neill was right. And the reality is, I have to keep reminding myself of this every single day since October 7. Since October 7, the trajectory of this conflict, the escalation, the de-escalation, the ambitions, the motives, how it ultimately is going to end, has basically been dominated by the two non-combatants. What this has conflict has shown is the limits of great powers' capacities, even if they have the influence on paper, as the U.S. does, to alter the trajectories of two parties who believe they are in an existential conflict. And right now, the Secretary of State's facing a very important decision this week, May 8. He's got to certify that the assurances the Israelis have provided under the National Security Memorandum 25, that they are abiding by international humanitarian law and not obstructing humanitarian assistance into Gaza, that those assurances that the Israelis have provided are, quote, credible and reliable. There are a lot of people who don't believe that, including many in the Democratic Party, including mainstream Democratic senators. What the Secretary of State is going to decide, unclear. But that certainly that's a potential lever. But even if he pulled that, the question is whether or not that's going to change the trajectory of the Netanyahu government. I don't think so.
All right. Aaron David Miller of the Carnegie Endowment, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
In the day's other headlines, Russia announced drills to simulate the use of battlefield nuclear weapons in its war with Ukraine. It followed French talk of sending its own troops to Ukraine and the UK's approval of Ukraine using British weapons to strike inside Russia. A Kremlin statement on the war games said, quote, "We hope that this event will cool down the hotheads in Western capitals." But in Paris, European Union leader Ursula von der Leyen met with Chinese President Xi Jinping and French President Emmanuel Macron and said she hopes China will intervene.
President Xi has played an important role in de-escalating Russia's irresponsible nuclear threats, and I'm confident that President Xi will continue to do so against the backdrop of the ongoing nuclear threats by Russia.
Moscow also called in the British and French ambassadors today and warned them against provocative statements. The U.S. Army confirms tonight that an American soldier has been arrested in the Russian Far East. Officials say the unidentified soldier was supposed to be headed home from deployment in South Korea, but was detained Thursday in Vladivostok, accused of theft. The Army has not said whether the service member was considered AWOL, absent without leave. Authorities in southern Brazil now say at least 83 people have died following days of heavy rains and flooding, with more than 100 people still missing. The downpours hit the state of Rio Grande do Sul, triggering landslides, road closures, and widespread power blackouts. Entire neighborhoods in the city of Canoas are underwater, with many houses almost completely submerged. Some people have resorted to driving power boats through the streets. Back in this country, heavy rains across southeastern Texas began to taper off, but catastrophic flooding left widespread disruption and closed some schools. People in Harris County around Houston have begun surveying damage and cleaning up. Officials today said they'd been fortunate to escape with no fatalities.
That happens, of course, because of our first responders, but also because of the individuals in the community who heeded our warnings and who took responsible steps in evacuating themselves and their families.
One death was reported in Johnson County, Texas. A 4-year-old boy was killed when floodwaters swept away the car he was in. Boeing's first manned spaceflight on its Starliner capsule is set for launch later tonight, heading to the International Space Station. The craft is set to lift off from Kennedy Space Center in Florida with two astronauts on board. They'll return to Earth after a week. A successful flight could help Boeing begin catching up to rival SpaceX. The Pulitzer Prizes for 2023 have been announced. They include the Public Service Award to ProPublica for reporting on billionaires giving gifts and travel to U.S. Supreme Court justices. The Associated Press won the Feature Photography Prize. Its work chronicled migrants traveling from as far as Colombia to the U.S. southern border. The prize for fiction went to Night Watch by Jane Ann Phillips, a novel set in West Virginia after the Civil War. And on Wall Street, stocks added to last week's gains on some fresh corporate earnings reports. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 176 points to close at 38,852. The Nasdaq rose 193 points. The S&P 500 added 53. Still to come on the NewsHour, as more colleges cancel graduation ceremonies, a look at how universities are handling campus protests. A new study finds hormone replacement therapy is safe and effective. And Tamara Keith and Amy Walter break down the latest political headlines.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
On the stand today in New York City were two former employees of the Trump Organization. They were involved in the payments that are at the very center of the charges filed against the former president in his hush money trial. Jeffrey McConney and Deborah Tarasoff helped reimburse Mr. Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen, for the payments Cohen made to adult film actress Stormy Daniels during the final days of the 2016 campaign. The former president also received another fine and a tough warning from the judge in this case, who again said if Trump continues to violate the court's gag order, he could face jail time. Ximena Bustillo is covering this trial for NPR, and she joins us now. Ximena, so nice to see you again. So today we heard from these two former financial officers of the Trump Organization who were part of paying and accounting for these payments to Michael Cohen. What did we learn today from their testimony?
Right. So the former and current employees of the Trump Organization really detailed step by step the process for reviewing vouchers, invoices, and ultimately cutting checks at the Trump Organization. So we looked at almost all, if not all, of the 34 business records that the prosecution is alleging that the Trump Organization and Trump himself falsified in order to hide the actual reason why he was issuing these payments to then Trump lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen. And they really went through the process of how the check gets cut, how it gets invoiced, how it got signed by Trump himself. And that was a very long, lengthy process that we went through with both of them.
We have heard previous testimony that Donald Trump was aware of payments that were made directly to women to keep their stories quiet. Did we get any closer to understanding what Trump did or didn't know about these alleged repayments of some of that money to Michael Cohen?
So today we did learn that Trump himself was responsible for signing these checks. Now, the defense is still trying to create distance between Trump and the actual reason that the checks were cashed to Michael Cohen in the first place, asking the witnesses whether or not they got direct direction from Trump to issue these payments and pay stubs. Some of them said no, that came from other direction, and also saying that getting these kinds of directives was not necessarily out of the ordinary. So we're still kind of connecting the dots in terms of how much Trump knew, at what point was he involved, and what kind of direction and strengths he was pulling. So those are still questions that the prosecution needs to fully answer.
And separately, this day began with Judge Mershon finding that Donald Trump had again violated the gag order, fined him another $1,000, and said, next time, if you violate this again, I could potentially sentence you to jail. What was it that I mean, Trump, I take it he also said in between court today that he would welcome something like that. He'd be honored or something to go to jail. What was the judge responding to? What had Trump done that set him off?
So last week, the prosecution took issue with four statements that Trump had made earlier a few weeks ago. And ultimately, Judge Juan Merchan issued a violation on one of the statements. And that was a statement that Trump had made in an interview where he accused the jury of being, quote, 95% Democrat. This statement, the judge himself said last week, was concerning to him. Any kind of inference or character judgment on the jury. Judge Merchan is very protective of this jury. It's supposed to be an anonymous jury, and he's taken a lot of steps to make sure that they are safe and protected from any sort of intimidation or threats. Now, Judge Merchan has also previously said that $1,000 is the max penalty that can be issued per violation. So last week, we also saw a different set of gag order violations totaling $9,000. This time, it was only $1,000. Now, Judge Merchan has said that he's aware that for someone like Donald Trump, who is wealthy and of a higher stature, that fine might not be enough to deter future violations or future breaking of the gag order. And so that's where the punishment and threat of jail time comes into play. And that's something that the judge has threatened before. But this morning, he was particularly very pointed. In fact, he didn't even really talk about the order on the stand and instead took his time to tell former President Donald Trump that if he were to violate this order again or continue to do so, he will take the necessary steps and maybe even resource to jail.
Ximena Bustillo of NPR, thank you so much.
Thank you.
As the school year nears its end, there are still many protests about Gaza on campuses nationwide. While many are peaceful, tensions on campuses remain. Columbia University today canceled its main graduation ceremony, saying it'll hold individual ones instead for each school. This week, we will continue to hear a range of opinions on these protests, on free speech, and on concerns over student safety. Today, Lisa Desjardins looks at how schools have viewed protests in the past and how they're approaching them now.
William, some universities have explicitly promoted their own history with nonviolent protests in recent years. But as colleges are grappling with the balance of free speech, civil disobedience, and concerns over student safety, there's been a wave of arrests and crackdown on many campuses. We've heard some college officials argue these measures are necessary and overdue, while protesters and some faculty say it's been too harsh in some cases. Tyler Austin Harper wrote about this for The Atlantic. He's an assistant professor of environmental studies at Bates College and joins me now. Tyler, you are looking squarely at universities and arguing that their own rhetoric is part of this. And you wrote that, quote, the same colleges that appeal to students by promoting opportunities for engagement and activism are now suspending them and they're calling the cops. What do you mean by hypocrisy here?
Yeah, so a lot of the universities that we've seen have especially draconian measures, with student protesters either suspending them or in some cases calling the police, are often the same universities that like to champion their history of past protests. So Cornell, Columbia, Emory, for example, all like to brag about their history of radical student activism in the Vietnam War era. Cornell actively celebrates an armed takeover of a campus building in 1969. They did a year's worth of programming for it on the 50th anniversary. Likewise, Columbia celebrates its student protests from 1968, which involved the takeover of a campus building that was recently taken over by protesters again. And yet now they, you know, after bragging about this history, they want to crack down on contemporary protesters at this very moment, which seems to me deeply hypocritical.
Another example I know you highlighted this weekend was at the University of Virginia, even as police were moving in on protesters, the university was holding a symposium on sort of its own massive resistance in the past. How do you know you're not cherry-picking these specific examples from universities? When you talk to students and faculties there, do they say that this was part of their motivation for going to campus?
Yeah, absolutely. I talked to a number of current faculty, students, incoming students, and really across the board from incoming to current undergrads to graduate students at places like Cornell and Columbia. They said, you know, this was part of the brand. This is part of why I came here. One person I talked to, a faculty member in the wake of the NYPD arrests at Columbia, actually asked his students, you know, is this something that attracted you to this campus? And he told me that overwhelmingly his students in class said, you know, they think protest is part of Columbia's brand and they actively market it to them. I would also point out that at a series of recent admitted student day events, the university has been communicating with students by saying, you know, you might see protests on campus, but you should understand this as part of our proud legacy of student activism. Mm-hmm. So even after the NYPD is called, Columbia is still boasting about its, you know, legacy of protest to incoming students. So yeah, this is a sentiment that I really heard across the board and that you can also see in how the university communicates.
You're talking about a hypocrisy you see here, but at the same time, we know on some campuses there has been evidence of real anti-Semitism. On others, universities are saying they're nervous that there could be some, even if there isn't evidence. How do you draw the line? When should universities draw a line and actually kind of step up against protests?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a complicated question that relates in part to the First Amendment. There's definitely language being used that I find, you know, inappropriate. And then there's definitely some language being used that is plainly anti-Semitic. I think it's relatively part of the fringe of these protests rather than the center of it. But the unfortunate reality or the, you know, whatever your perspective is, the reality is that the First Amendment protects hateful speech. The relevant question is to whether or not these students are by encamping on university grounds, if they've moved themselves out of the territory of protected speech by breaking the law. That's a complicated question. One thing that First Amendment experts I spoke to reiterated time and again is that where the university seemed to be running afoul is rather than targeting specific protesters who might be engaging in kinds of speech that is not protected and just removing those students, they're doing broad crackdowns on these protests. So they're infringing on the rights of some students who are engaged in lawful speech that is protected by the First Amendment. And these universities are curtailing their speech rights on the grounds that a smaller subset of students might be breaking the rules in some way.
You seem to be saying here, universities have told students and actually have benefited from this idea that we advocate for protests, we advocate for activism, yet here they are, as you see it, repressing that kind of activism. Conservatives for a long time have said universities have lost their way into sort of a land of liberal nonsense that's misguided. Is this an area where someone like you on the left might agree with conservatives that universities are losing their mooring?
Yeah, I agree with part of what conservatives are saying. You know, conservatives are saying that universities have become too political and administrations have become too political. I think that's correct. I think universities like the University of Chicago, which have stricter regulations around political speech from university administrators, they've handled recent events a bit better and weathered the storm better. Where I think conservatives get things wrong is by arguing that universities are hotbeds of, you know, far left indoctrination. If you look at many of the universities like Princeton, Penn, Columbia, et cetera, that are at the center of these events, those are universities that overwhelmingly are sending people to big tech jobs, to finance, to consulting, et cetera. So if these are places that are trying to indoctrinate far left Marxists, they're doing a very bad job. But I do think conservatives are onto something with you know, the question about the politicalization of universities. I think they're right in that limited sense.
Tyler Austin Harper, it is a complicated conversation, and we thank you for joining us for it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
She went from being the center of attention in women's professional basketball to the center of a global power struggle. 2 years after she was first detained in Russia, Brittany Griner is sharing new details about her time in prison and the fight to free her. It's all in her new book, Coming Home, which is out tomorrow. Amna Nawaz recently met up with Griner at the YMCA of Greater New York for a rare TV interview.
No, sure. I'm off now.
Here, I got you.
It's all you.
See,
it's all you.
I did my job. Put you back. Saw I got the rebound. Put back. I put up.
For basketball superstar Brittany Griner, better known as BG, the court has always been a safe space.
Even walking in, the smell of the floor and the hardwood, it was just It just felt natural. It felt home. It felt like the beginning of basketball for me.
Born and raised in Houston, Texas, Griner was a breakout star at Baylor University, dunking her way to fame and a pro career with the Phoenix Mercury, 6 WNBA All-Star appearances, and 2 Olympic gold medals. But for Griner, standing tall at 6'8" meant standing out.
Basketball!
You talk so openly, so honestly in your book about what it took to get you comfortable in your own skin.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote, "When you're born in a body like mine, a part of you dies every day. With every mean comment and lingering stare, you're the biggest person in the room, but you're also the loneliest."
Mm-hmm.
Did basketball help with that?
Basketball definitely helped. It gave me a purpose. It gave me an outlet, too, when I'm frustrated. It gave me somewhere to go and channel that energy in a positive way. And it gave me camaraderie as well, like my teammates, my coaches, that sense of feeling wanted from the fans, like all that helped me. Once I started playing basketball, it really changed my life.
Basketball took her overseas, like many women players, for a second job during the WNBA offseason. Since 2014, Griner played for European powerhouse team UMMC Ekaterinburg in Russia.
She really loved playing in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me why.
I did. I mean, the pay gap is pretty big, you know, from here to overseas. And, you know, just feeling valued like that meant a lot to me. And then just how they treated us, our safety, the way we flew, where we stayed at. I mean, we stayed at the best hotels. We flew on private jets, and we really felt like professional athletes.
How different was that to how you were treated here in the States?
Definitely different. You know, you might catch me on a United or Southwest or Delta flight, maybe middle row. It just depends. I was definitely overseas because that's where I was able to make a living for my family.
State Department says it's aware of the arrest of an American citizen in Moscow.
Everything changed in 2022.
Russian customs officials claim they detected cannabis oil in her luggage.
On February 17th, as she returned to Russia to rejoin her team, Griner was detained at Sheremetyevo Airport outside of Moscow when vape cartridges with less than a gram of hashish oil, illegal in Russia, were found in her luggage. Griner has a prescription for medical marijuana in the U.S., but forgot to remove the cartridges while packing in a rush.
You almost didn't make that flight. You were running late. You lost your phone. You got held up, missed your connection.
Mm-hmm.
Does any part of you look back on that day now and think, gosh, if only I'd done X, if only I'd done Y?
Every single part of it.
There's this idea of guilt through your book. You worry about what your mom and dad went through while you were away, what Rel went through, what your teammates were going through. Has that guilt gone away?
I think it's always going to be there a little bit, and that's just my character. That's who I am. Because at the end of the day.
Why?
It's on me. As much as everything was an accident and not intended, it's on me. It was my fault. There were so many signs, and I really wanted to stay back, honestly. But my dad, if you finish what you start, and we were right in the... basically about to win EuroLeague and going to win Russian League as well, like we have in the past for many years. So I wanted to finish that chapter completely.
Hi, Brittany. How are you?
Instead, a new surreal chapter in her life began, detention in Russian prison. Her face and story splashed across international headlines and robbed of the one safe space she'd always had.
When you weren't able to play, what did that feel like?
That was hard. It was really hard not being able to play, not knowing what was to come, if I would ever pick up a basketball professionally again. It was devastating to me to think about.
BG took the time to write President Biden.
Back home, her devastated wife, Sherelle, led the charge to free BG, working with her teammates, her agent, Lindsay Kagawa Coles, and an army rallying behind the We Are BG hashtag.
You write that the campaign had to make me visible in a world where black women are often ignored or demeaned. It had to make me relatable.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'm black, gay, a female baller, but when people saw my face and heard my story, we needed them to say, hey, she's me.
Mm-hmm.
Were you worried about being able to do that?
Definitely. I mean, in a world where you're judged by just appearance and or maybe what, you know, a certain group has done or someone has wronged them so they condemn everyone that looks like them, I was definitely worried. I was definitely worried about the public opinion and how people would react.
Griner, meanwhile, could do nothing but wait and survive.
It makes you not want to fight. It makes you kind of give up hope. I mean, you're already, like, I'm sitting in court and I'm trying to plead, but I'm already locked up. I'm already in a cage. I feel like I talked about feeling like a zoo animal, you know, especially how the guards would come and just open the little peephole to see me, and then I hear the snickering going down the hallway. I was a spectacle.
That feeling of feeling like they're all watching you, like you're a spectacle, was that something you'd ever felt before?
Definitely. Growing up, I definitely felt like a spectacle. I remember in junior high, you know, the girls coming up to me and literally talking to somebody else, touch my chest and say, oh, see, she's not really a real girl. She has no chest. Like, listen to her voice. So I've always been that spectacle of pointing and looking at. It was already a depressing and challenging time, and it just made it even worse.
You were detained on February 17th.
Mm-hmm.
It was on February 24th that Russia invaded Ukraine. Do you believe that you were being held as a bargaining chip?
100%. There's no doubt in my mind that once they knew who I was and they had me, that I'm your value target. I'm your value, you know, bargaining chip. You don't feel like a human anymore. Like, I didn't feel like my life was mine. It was in someone else's hands. It was in other people's hands. It's a feeling that I never want to feel ever again.
Where do you go in your head in those moments? What do you tell yourself? What do you do?
I did a lot of gazing out of the windows to the point where I could, like, make the bars disappear and I would just see land, because that's my sanctuary. I love being in nature. Once I got to the penal colony to go outside, well, right outside the cell, walk into the workstation, just admiring the distance behind the walls, behind everything. Did a lot of looking up at the birds.
What'd you think when you saw those birds outside the cell?
Must be nice to be able to fly away.
A Russian court eventually sentenced Griner to 9 years in prison. In part two of our interview tomorrow, she shares the grueling conditions inside a notorious Russian labor camp, the moment she'll never forget once she was freed, and what life ahead looks like for her and her wife, Sherelle. That's part two of Omnis Conversation with Brittany Griner tomorrow night on the NewsHour. Menopause can be a long, brutal, and sometimes debilitating condition for many women. And according to a new analysis published in the medical journal JAMA, it's time to reconsider hormone therapy as an important treatment. Stephanie Tsai has our look.
Women in the throes of menopause know the transition is anything but fun. The symptoms can include hot flashes, irritability, migraines, and changes in sexual desire and function. Hormone replacement therapy has ebbed and flowed in its popularity over three decades with a mixed picture of its risks and benefits. This new review of long-running data suggests that for women in early menopause, the benefits of hormone replacement therapy do outweigh the risks. For a closer look at the evidence, I'm joined by Dr. Lauren Stryker. She's a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Dr. Stryker, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour. So in the early 2000s, there was a lot of fear that started to emerge around hormone replacement therapy's correlation with breast cancer and other diseases. Can you just put into context how disruptive those findings were for women's health back then and how this new study fits into our understanding of safety today?
Well, certainly what happened 22 years ago when the WHI was first released was a huge deal because it was terrifying for the millions of women who'd been taking their hormone therapy, thinking that not only would it relieve their menopause symptoms, but that it might also help in terms of prevention of chronic diseases. And within one day, people were literally flushing their hormone therapy down the toilet out of fear that this hormone therapy that had been recommended by their doctors was going to give them breast cancer, heart disease, blood clots. And this completely changed the trajectory of not only women's attitudes about hormone therapy, but doctors' attitudes about hormone therapy. Now, just to be clear, this is not a new study. This is not new data. This is a new statement about old data from a study which, quite frankly, was poorly designed from the get-go, using hormone therapy that's no longer even prescribed by most experts.
The WHI, just to be clear, is the Women's Health Initiative. This is the large sample of women that you're talking about. And this new data, this new analysis looks at this old data. So let's just break this down. When does a woman know when she may benefit from hormone replacement therapy and when it might not be a good idea?
Well, that's actually a complicated question because we're really looking at two groups of symptoms. We're looking at the short-term issues, the hot flashes, the vaginal dryness, the brain fog, the moodiness, the insomnia, but we're also looking at big picture, at long-term issues, not only prevention of chronic disease such as heart disease, which is the number one thing that kills women, but things like different cancers, breast cancer, uterine cancer, cognitive function down the road, joint pain, sexual function. So in terms of which women would benefit, well, clearly the group that's going to benefit at the onset of menopause are the women who are having the severe symptoms, particularly hot flashes and insomnia. And there's this idea that hot flashes aren't harmful. Dress in layers, carry a fan, you'll get through it. Well, first of all, we know that they last an average of 7 to 10 years. And in fact, hot flashes are correlated with heart disease and other serious long-term medical issues. So clearly women that are having these symptoms early in menopause are candidates for hormone therapy. But the bigger question is, what about the long term? And when we look at bone health specifically, this is a big deal. Women die from osteoporosis, and so they may not have any symptoms of bone loss during perimenopause, but they are starting to lose bone. And we know from this WHI data that women who start their hormone therapy in that golden period of time between 50 and 60 have a 33% decreased risk of fracture. But the minute they go off their hormone therapy, they start to lose bone again. So we're not just talking about short-term hormone therapy. We're talking about long-term hormone therapy, quite frankly, lifelong hormone therapy, to prevent those kinds of long-term problems which cause women to not only have a significant decrease in quality of life, but also length of life.
And what about women that do need to be concerned about any potential risks with this therapy? I'm thinking of, for example, breast cancer survivors.
Yeah. Well, when we look at, there's two groups of women when we're talking about breast cancer specifically. There are women that are concerned about getting breast cancer, and then there are the women that already have a breast cancer diagnosis. So let's first just quickly talk about women who are concerned about getting breast cancer. What we know, and this is not controversial, this is not only from WHI data, but many subsequent studies, is that women that take estrogen alone have a 20% decrease in getting breast cancer. We also know that women who have breast cancer who are taking hormone therapy at the time that they're taking breast cancer have a 40% decreased risk of dying from breast cancer. So estrogen is protective. And this is what this is the message that is not getting out, both from women talking to other women, but also really problematically by clinicians. Physicians are not advising patients to take hormone therapy. They're not comfortable with it. Most physicians, quite frankly, weren't trained in hormone therapy because they trained after the WHI.
Dr. Lauren Stryker, a continuing conversation we'll have to have from Northwestern University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's already shaping up to be a busy political week as Republicans navigate the fallout from controversial remarks made by former President Trump at a fundraiser over the weekend. Meanwhile, 6 months out from the election, President Biden continues to deal with a jaded electorate as he wrestles with the political ramifications of the war in Gaza. Following this all closely is our Politics Monday duo, Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of NPR. So nice to see you both. Happy Monday. 6 months out, as I just mentioned, from this election, this weekend, Donald Trump was at this campaign event, and he made these comments where he basically equated the Biden White House with the Nazis, saying that they are running a, quote, Gestapo administration. Now, this is obviously, Amy, just the latest in a long history of Trump saying things like this. But one of his fellow Republicans, one who's vying to be the number two on the Trump ticket, North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, came out and defended Donald Trump. Here's what he had to say.
A majority of Americans feel like the trial that he's in right now is politically motivated. And if it was anybody else, this trial wouldn't even be happening. So I understand that he feels like that he's being unfairly treated.
So feeling like a trial is unfair is equivalent to being part of the Nazi secret police.
Well, first, let's talk about that the majority of Americans, as the governor said right there, feel that this is unfair, which, according to the most recent poll, the NPR PBS Marist poll, that is not true. 54% in that poll thought that it's fair. Now, 46% think it's unfair. So there are a lot of people who think the way that the North Dakota governor does. But if we think that this candidate, Trump, or a Trump 2.0 president is going to look any different than the candidate we've known since 2016 or the person who was president for 4 years, you're going to be sorely mistaken. This is the reality of this is just who Donald Trump is, how he's going to operate, how he is going to speak and behave. What we are seeing as well, as you pointed out, Doug Burgum on reportedly on the short list to be a vice presidential candidate, is that loyalty to Donald Trump is always important. I think in a Trump 2.0, it will be very, very top priority in picking who is around him. And so when we talk about, well, what are the constraints or what are the restraints or the guardrails around a Trump presidency for things that he says or does? Who's going to maybe rein him in, stand up and say no in the way that the vice president Mike Pence did? These folks are not saying that
I won't do that.
I'm pretty good with the way that Trump is going to operate.
Right now, we are in the audition phase of the vice presidential pick contest, or you know, like an episode of The Bachelor or something. They had this event in Palm Beach. They brought all of these candidates, potential vice presidential picks in, and then many of them went out on the Sunday shows. And what they had to do was show their loyalty to former President Trump. He, as Amy said, he does not want another vice president who will be loyal to him only up until when it matters and when the Constitution is on the line. He wants someone who will go out there and prove and tie themselves in knots, like Senator Tim Scott did on Meet the Press, just tie themselves in knots to stick with the reality that is Trump's reality, even if it is not true.
Let's take a look at what Tim Scott had to say, because he was asked about, will you accept the election results regardless of who wins? Here's what he had to say.
Well, Senator, will you commit to accepting the election results of 2024, bottom line?
Well, at the end of the day, the 47th president of the United States will be President Donald Trump, and I'm excited to give back to low inflation, low unemployment.
Wait, Senator, yes or no? Yes or no? Will you accept the election results of 2024, no matter who wins?
That is my statement.
I mean, Kristen Welker went back and forth about this multiple times.
And this is relevant because former President Trump is still denying the results of the last election. He is going to Wisconsin and Michigan and saying, oh, no, I actually won here, when he didn't. So it's entirely relevant whether you will accept the results of the 2024 election. He has also said in that Time magazine interview that it came out last week that, you know, he doesn't think that there will be violence or any issues as long as the election is fair. But at the same time, he is saying that the last election, which was fair, wasn't.
Fair meaning I won.
Generally speaking, yeah.
Amy, meanwhile, Biden has got polling that, again, showing not great news for his campaign. We want to put up this graphic here. Majority of the U.S. adults, 54%, disapprove of Biden's performance. That is a 3% jump since March. Now, that's within the margin of error, but it is his worst rating since 2019. I mean, how panicked should that campaign be?
Well, he is deeply unpopular, but he's not that much more unpopular than Donald Trump is. And the poll that you're citing, are the Marist poll, so Donald Trump's overall approval rating is 42%, the president being at 40%. Where we sit right now is really fascinating. It feels like this campaign has been going on for about 100 years, because it basically has. We're rerunning 2020.
You both look great for 100-year-old
people. Thank you. Appreciate that. The focus right now is on Joe Biden. He's the president now. Obviously, 4 years ago, it was Donald Trump. If the question is, should we go, which president do you think did a better job in his first term? Right now, Trump is winning that argument. And you see in poll after poll, when they ask questions about who you think did a better job on the economy? Whose policies do you think have helped you the most, Biden or Trump? Trump is beating Biden on those metrics. But if you talk about a campaign which is about the future, that's the conversation that we haven't really gotten into yet. And that's why you saw even the Tim Scott interview, you hear the surrogates as well as Donald Trump talk a lot about, remember back in the days, let's bring us back to those days of 4 years ago when the economy was great and inflation was low. So remember how great those times were. It's up to the Biden campaign to make the case that, not so much to fight about whether those times were great, but to talk about the next 4 years and what an administration of Biden's would look like and his policies, and compare them to Donald Trump's.
Which is why the Biden campaign continues to highlight all of the things that Trump says, like the Gestapo comments and everything else that he has said, while also really trying to amplify what he is saying he would do.
That's right.
And in particular on abortion rights, where he is trying not to say what he would do, and on any number of policy matters. You know, in that Time magazine interview again, where he talked about wanting to round up migrants.
Right, deploy the military inside the U.S.
Yes, and then he was asked, well, but the military being used on civilians? And he said, oh, no, they're not civilians, which is a pretty significant departure from norms.
Right.
Yeah, and the case hasn't really been prosecuted yet.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, we are still, feels like either 6 months you think is a long time from now or a very short time from now. I tend to think of it as a short time. I think most normal voters think, well, we're a long way away from the election.
So they just haven't dialed in yet.
Yeah, and both candidates soon enough will be on the airwaves making their case to voters. Theoretically, there will be debates between these candidates where the differences between the two will become more of the conversation.
Theoretically, on those debates. Amy Walter, yes. Tamara Keith, so nice to see you both. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Sam.
And join us again here tomorrow night for a look at the debate surrounding language and free speech on college campuses, driven by the protests against the war in Gaza. That is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm William Brangham. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you so much for joining us.